All right, it's 7 o'clock, kids. Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. We will, this happened last week and made somebody nervous. You will see a recording button going on. It is our intention of recording and publishing only the audio portion of this meeting. No video will be recorded or kept. So really just what's said here is what is being captured. So I hope that is okay with everybody. If it's not, you know it now. Ask a basket questions should go to the user questions. You will see a user called questions. If you bring up the chat, please be thinking about questions that we'll ask Jerry. We're going to give him the first hour, and then at the top of the hour, we'll take a little break and do the seventh tradition, etc. And we'll take a couple of AA-related announcements at that time. I've got a link out in the right-hand side for the seventh tradition and PayPal. Or if you have PayPal, you can go to paypal.me/simpleactions when that time comes. So for those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. I'd like to ask if there's anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety. We would just like to welcome you. If you could raise your virtual blue hand or wave at the window or something. Angel, welcome. Megan, welcome. Really grateful you guys are here. You're the reason we're here. All right. So if any ladies would like to distribute their numbers, just send them to one of the hosts and the host can pass them on. BJ is a host on this Zoom meeting. Could I have a volunteer to read the AA preamble? Maybe BJ.
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks.
Thank you. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker / ask it basket. Tonight we are very excited to have Jerry W. from Raleigh, North Carolina, tell his story. Jerry's been kind enough to come up and do our supper and a speaker events. He also was, he and Rich B. Did a whole weekend with us a few years back, and those recordings, by the way, I get more comments on those recordings of anything we've put out on our website from that particular weekend. So, and just a reminder, please remember to think about questions, and I'm going to get out of your way, Jerry. I'm just so excited to have you come here tonight and share with us. Welcome, Jerry.
Right. Thanks, Dave. Great to be here. My name is Jerry Weaver, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
And my sobriety date is July 2nd, 1989. I've got a sponsor, and matter of fact, I just got off the phone with him a few minutes ago. He said a prayer for me and got me straight before I got on here. And I also have a home group. And my home group meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays in Holly Springs, North Carolina, just a little south of Raleigh. The name of our group is There Is a Solution. Two things I've always done in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've had a sponsor and I've had a home group. And I've stayed active and current in both for my entire sobriety. And they've both have made me kind of who the man I am today. And I've never once had any real strong thoughts about backing out of either one. And I don't know, you don't hear that much. People like talking about all the stuff they're not going to do. And that's kind of become real popular nowadays. But I those are just two things that I haven't always willingly called my sponsor, always willing to go into my home group. I don't want to imply that I just love both of those all the time, because I don't. But I've been able to stay consistent with both, regardless of what my mind's telling me. Because I've seen what happens to people now, literally thousands of people that don't do that. And I've sponsored hundreds of people throughout the years that have gotten off that track, and man, it doesn't end well for them. And I've learned more in Alcoholics Anonymous from watching what people don't do than I have from watching what they do of what I should do. So anyway, I say all that just to say I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be a member of a group. I'm grateful to my sponsor. And I've had a few sponsors. I had my current sponsor, he's been my sponsor for over 28 years. It's a long time. And David, I appreciate you asking me to speak. I wish you hadn't told me about I could come up with a topic, because my mind's been screwing with me ever since you said that. I gave a talk last week. I think it was in Boston, on faith and fear, which were actually it was freedom and faith. And I got a lot of experience with fear. I had a lot of it about 8 minutes ago. It's starting to slow down now. But, you know, those are things that have been on my mind lately. And unity's been on my mind a lot. And seeing how people in the fellowship have kind of unified around each other in the last few months, and a lot of support from people, and a lot of members going out of their way to make sure the other folks are taken care of, which is really a big part of our fellowship. And practicing principles on all affairs have been on the line a lot too. I obviously can't talk about all that stuff, but I'm also a dude that loves to tell my story. I guess we love talking about ourselves. But I think I'm going to talk a little bit about practicing principles and all your affairs. Before I got sober, I didn't have any clue what any of that meant. I was a guy that started drinking when I was 12 years old. And I mean, I grew up in a family where a lot of drinking took place, and I saw the damage that it did to people's lives. And I mean, I knew that at least for my family, I know a lot of people drink responsibly and socially, but were they in my family? And so I saw what alcoholism did to people, and I had all kinds of reasons to not drink. But I was also a young kid that was full of fear and full of doubt and confusion and just felt out of place. I never felt right. I felt like I should be somewhere other than where I was at. My mind would just have all kinds of nonsense going on in it. My stomach was anxious and was just full of fear. I mean, that's my earliest memory, is just fear. And I found out at the age of 12, by basically just experimenting, that whiskey would take that away. I was in the basement of a house in Springfield, Virginia, me and that guy, my friend, his dad, they were gone, and he had this big bar with all kinds of stuff, and we decided we were going to drink some old granddad. And we drank old granddad, and basically what happened was I had a spiritual experience that night, and that fear and all that doubt and all that confusion that I had about myself, it just disappeared. Alcohol just, it literally transformed me, just like flipping on a switch, and a light bulb comes on. That's kind of what happened to me. I remember that night just like it's tonight. And all that stuff went away, and it gave me power. And I loved it. I woke up the next morning in a pile of vomit. I blacked out later on in the evening and couldn't remember everything that happened. I was sick as a dog, and it was just, it was wonderful. And I, as sick as I was the next morning, I didn't swear it off forever. I knew that I was going to do it again. And basically what happened was every opportunity I got to drink, I drank. And I created opportunities to drink by shoplifting alcohol from 7-Elevens, stealing it from other kids' parents when they were, you know, right after school, and hiding it out in the woods and sneaking out. And I just became, even before I was a teenager, I was just a chaotic, rebellious dude. And I loved it. And it was all that I really was concerned about. And not long after that, found out about heavy metal music and girls and strobe lights and house parties, and I just loved it. And what happened was I continued to drink as a teenager. I got into a lot of trouble. Now, I'm not a guy that's got to drink to get into trouble. I hear people in the program say that every time they drank, they didn't get in trouble. But every time they got in trouble, they were drinking. Now, I get in a lot of trouble not drinking. I love being a troublemaker. I kind of thrived on that. I got in a lot of trouble, and I was facing prison time at age 17. I got charged with assault with a deadly weapon, intent to kill, and assault on a police officer, and had been kicked out of two school systems. I got kicked out of the Fairfax County school system and the Stafford County school system in Virginia, and was told I couldn't come back. I ended up going in the military at 18 to prevent from going to prison. Thought the military was going to fix me, the Air Force was going to fix me. I continued to drink. I continued to black out. I'd wake up in places, and people would have to tell me what I did the night before. I'd wake up with people that I didn't know, just on and on and on. I got married around this time, very young, thinking that was going to teach me some responsibility. That didn't work. I had a somewhat of a responsible job in the Air Force. I worked on electronic systems on airplanes. I worked on airplanes drunk. And liquor really started to cause me problems with my marriage and with mostly with my in-laws because of the way I was treating their daughter. And at work, I'd show up drunk and be late for roll call, and things would happen. And in my mind, it was always somebody else's fault. Now, I'm not a guy that takes responsibility for anything. Everything that happened to me was always somebody else's fault. I lived in this kind of self-pity world, woe is me. And if you had a childhood I had, if you had just the same wife I had, if you had the job I had, you know, these are all problems. And, you know, it was just this, I loved self-pity. And I didn't have the ability to look at myself. And what happened was people started kind of questioning me about my drinking, the way I was living. And I didn't think I had a problem. I just thought if you leave me alone, things would be all right. Well, guess what? They left me alone and things got worse. And I went down into a deep, deep valley. And I couldn't get out of it. I started to try ways to get my life in order through church and psychiatry and taking pills and counselor and reading books, reading spiritual books, and I'd pray, and I tried yoga, and I became a vegetarian before anybody knew what vegetarians were, and or before it was cool, I should say. And I thought that if I exercised and ate right, that they would, it would change something. I mean, that's kind of the delusion that, that I was in, was that, man, if I could just change the outside and look good or feel good, things would be different. And basically, I shaved my head. So I'm walking around with a bald head, eating tomatoes, reading the Bible and listening to gospel music and preaching to people. And I'd go to work and preach to people and tell them they got to stop living the way they're living. And then I'd sneak out to the parking lot and pop me a couple of Percocets and drink some more of that Thunderbird wine. And then I'd go back in and preach to them some more. And it was just crazy as hell. I mean, I was just in full flight from reality. What happened was I got suicidal. And I gave up. I mean, I wanted my life to get better. I wanted to change, but I didn't know I had alcoholism. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had never been introduced to that or even heard anything about that. And so I really didn't know what was wrong with me. So I'm trying to fix something or recover from something. I don't even know what it is. And none of the well-intended people that tried to help me in the church and through psychiatry ever mentioned anything like alcoholism or 12 steps or Alcoholics Anonymous. That was never mentioned. So I got suicidal and committed suicide 3 times. And I died a few times. I shot up some poison that a veterinarian would use to kill mange on a dog and was really trying to check out. I mean, I just wanted to die. And I ended up in the hospital. That was the second suicide attempt. I ended up in the hospital for 5 days. I got out of the hospital. I knew I would never go back to drinking after going through that experience. I mean, it just, common sense would tell you, man, that boy's done. I was out of the hospital 3 days. And my mind started messing with me. And the next thing you know, I convinced myself that if I ate a Slim Jim, and bought an 8-ounce beer instead of a 12-ounce or a 16-ounce beer, that things would be different. It'd be okay. So I stopped at the convenience store. Now I'm 8 days sober. I'm 3 days out of the hospital from dying and basically destroying my family. That experience just destroyed the family. And I'm out of the hospital for 3 days. And I think if I eat a Slim Jim and buy a Pony Budweiser instead of a Tall Boy, it's going to be okay. I stopped up. I've got me a, I'll never forget it. I stopped at this quick stop in Anderson Creek, North Carolina, and bought me a spicy Slim Jim and an 8-pack of Pony Budweiser. And I was off to races. And people thought I was absolutely insane. And I was. I was absolutely insane. And I got discharged out of the Air Force not long after that. Had suicide one more time. And obviously didn't die. But I was just in this world of, I wanted to change and I wanted things to be different. I was conflicted about the way I was living. I was conflicted about the way I was treating my family. But I didn't know what was wrong with me. One day I left the guy's house. I'd been up for 11 days. And, I left the guy's house to go write a bad check at a grocery store. Walking. About an 8-mile walk. And I was going to hitchhike. My plan was to get out of the main road and hitchhike into town. I don't know if people hitchhike anymore. They probably don't. They Uber or Lyft. But I didn't have any money. It wouldn't have done me any good. But I was going to get out in the road and hitchhike. And I mean, I knew somebody would pick me up. I knew a lot of people there. But something happened to me. I was walking down the road and like my whole life flashed before my eyes. And it was not like a blind and light experience. It was just this moment of clarity. Man, you just turned 22 years old. Your life should be starting. It shouldn't be ending. And I was a failure at living. I was a failure at dying. I attempted suicide and couldn't even do that successfully. I couldn't live successfully. And something happened to me where for the first time ever, truly, I wanted some help. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And as I was walking down that road, it was about 6 a.m. I said, there's got to be something better than this. And then I basically asked, I said out loud, God, please help me. And, you know, what I can report to you today is I've been sober ever since. And I believe I've gotten better from that day to this day. I don't know. Nah, my life is, if you can think about it, it's happened just about the last 30 years. But I've been able to stay sober through all of it. And there's one fact that I know that I've questioned and doubted everything that's ever happened to me since I've been sober. And I don't even know if some of it's real or not. But here's what I do know is that I've been sober ever since that day, and I haven't had a drink. And I haven't. That's a fact. And the only thing that has made a difference, the only thing that came into my life that's made a difference is Alcoholics Anonymous. It was nothing else. And it looked like what I needed that morning when I asked God for help was I needed some pills and a therapist. I needed my wife to come back, leave my cousin alone. And I needed, she's sleeping with my cousin. And that, I mean, head for your ego, self-esteem. I think I still got a little resentment over that. I might need to do a little writing on that. I needed a car and a job and, you know, all that stuff. And it looks like that's what you need. Man, I didn't get any of that. Through a series of kind of circumstances, I ended up in a detox that morning. Didn't know, it felt like jail to me. And I was on suicide watch. It was a Sunday morning. And this guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came in and started talking to me. I had no clue what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I remember this dude's taking time out of his Sunday morning to come talk to me. And all he did was tell his story. He didn't ask me a bunch of questions. He didn't tell me what he thought I should be doing. And I identified. And I knew that whatever he had, I had it. It was a classic 12-step call. And we're forgetting how to do that. But he just came in and just shared the language of the heart with me, and it changed my life. What happened was, after that, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous quickly. I was introduced to our literature. I was introduced to sponsorship. I was introduced to the importance of going to meetings. I was introduced to the importance of prayer. I was introduced to the importance of reading AA literature. I was introduced to a home group sponsorship, and was told that if I wanted to change and I didn't want to return to the old life, that there was a way out for me, and that there was an answer, and that it was very simple, just like the name of your group, simple actions. And I thank God for the men that and the women that I got introduced to when I first got sober, because they were all about getting sober, and they were all about enjoying life, and they were all about just taking simple actions, not anything goofy or heady or far-fetched, just simple little actions of prayer, contact with somebody, staying current, go to meetings, and try to help somebody. And while you're doing that, take the steps and clean up your past, and your life will change. Now, it ain't easy. But it is simple. And what I can tell you is that's what I did. I mean, I haven't looked back. I joined a group. I got a sponsor, and I took the steps. And I took the first 9 steps. I was sober about 8 weeks when I started making amends. Again, the people that I got in contact with told me that, hey, if you want to get better, this is what you got to do. Don't wait around or sit around. If you take just half the energy you put into drinking into the program, you'll do fine. And so I took those first 9 steps, and my life changed. And I'm like, you know, most people, I didn't have anything going for me. I had nowhere to live. I had no job. I had no money. I owed a lot of money. I had a wife that was messing around with another family member. I mean, it was rough getting sober. It's not easy. Alcoholics Anonymous and people in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me. They took care of me. They took an interest in me. And I was given just enough willingness, mostly because of the example of other people, to just walk through that fear. Walk through that fear and do that fifth step with that guy. Walk through the fear and go turn myself in for bad checks and warrants. walk through the fear and go back and talk to the grandmother that I hurt. Go back and talk to the family member. Go talk to the employer and tell the truth, regardless of the consequences to me. And man, I did that, and I was amazed at how willing people are to actually help you when you tell them the truth for the first time. That was a spiritual experience for me. And what happened was my life started to change, and I was taught immediately to help other people. And, you know, even sober a few days, I was told I could help God sober one day. And I believe that to be true today. I started sponsoring people very quickly. And what happened was my life started to change slowly over time. You know, we hear people talking a lot of times. It sounds like they get sober and their life just automatically gets better. And that's not the case for any of them. Slowly over time, I started to get better. And I started to change. And I started to have that spiritual experience that the book talks about, and the promises in the big book started to come true. And to me, that's just a description of a spiritual awakening, that I start to react differently to the world. I start to see things differently. I start to actually, you know, believe that I can have some value in the world and I'm not a piece of trash. And I start to see that I can actually be a good guy, and I can actually practice principles, and I can actually, you know, have a purpose in life. And so I say all that to say this, that in the 12th step, it talks about practicing principles in all our affairs. And I believe the steps got me whole, and the steps got me into a relationship with God, and the steps cleaned up my past to where I can have relationships with people. And it certainly has given me purpose. And then the question is, well, how do I grow on that? And I mean, and how do I expand on that? And I mean, obviously we do that in Alcoholics Anonymous through steps 10, 11, and 12. And that's how we continue to look at ourselves, and we continue to get better, and we continue to try to grow closer towards whatever power it is that we believe in. But for me, I was taught this early on, that the 12 traditions have more utility for everyday life. And if I really will keep an open mind and look at those traditions and think about how I can apply them in my personal life, not just in my group, but in my personal life, they have done way more for me in personal relationships than the steps. I'm not implying they're any more important than the steps. It's just my experience that they've really helped me with personal relationships, with business, with being in the community, with my family, by really kind of dissecting a little bit and looking at how does this apply to me in my life. And because the traditions ask me to do a lot of stuff that I don't like to do. They ask me to give up personal desires for what's best for the common welfare of other people. You know, and that we're taught in the steps that our main problem, or the root of our trouble, is selfishness and self-centeredness. So if I don't want to have any trouble, I got to get rid of selfishness and self-centeredness, which is difficult. But the traditions, if I can literally try to consciously apply those in my life, it'll help me do that. The first one talks about unity. Right. And I think for me, what I've got to do, and all this is stuff I've learned from other men in AA and some women. It's not stuff that I've come up with. But I really got to ask myself the question, do I really want to be a peacemaker? Right. Do I really want to be a child of God? Do I really want to try to be unified with my family and with people at work? Or, you know, do I really want to be unselfish? Do I really want to practice love and tolerance everywhere that I go? Or do I just want to give that lip service, and which I did for a number of years in meetings. I want to sound good in meetings and then go home and argue with the wife. Right, or it's supposed to sound good in meetings and then get out on the road and shoot the middle finger to somebody and then get out and threaten them. We've all done that, but at some point I got to grow up and really ask myself, do I really believe this and do I want to practice that? And the first tradition, you know, has taught me to really think about what's best for somebody else. And it's helped me to have power with people instead of power over people. Not be a governor, not to be the king, which my ego, you know, wants me to do. And it's all about and I'm a guy that likes the long form of the traditions. I think if you really want to know the intent of what the traditions meant when they first wrote them, you got to look at that. And because I don't know about anybody else, but before I got sober, I was a guy that was either less than or better than, depending on the circumstances. Right? Most of the time I felt less than other people. Sometimes I'd feel better than, and I was never just a part of. I was never just in the middle. I was never like neutral or just kind of at one with people. And the first tradition teaches me to do that. Right? It tells me I'm just a small part of a great whole, and that I can either get along with people or I can continue to be divisive and antagonistic. And I learned that first in my home group. I learned how to get along with people that I didn't like or that I disagreed with in an AA home group. And so I started trying to apply that at home. I started to think about what's best for my family, not what's best for me. When I go to work, what's best for my job? And I'll tell you, it's a goofy story, but it's a true story. Years ago, I worked for the same company for a long time, but years ago, we had just gotten into the retail business. So we were peddling our product through retail stores. We didn't have any experience with it. Well, they asked me to run the store. I got no experience with retail. I got no experience with any of that stuff, but they saw something I didn't see. And so we had to cover like all kinds of crazy hours. Our business was not used to. We were even open on Sundays then, which was like in North Carolina, was like, you know, taboo. You ain't opening on Sundays. So I was responsible for the schedule. I mean, I would stress over the schedule and people would complain and whine when it went out about when they had to work and when they weren't working. And this is a true story. One day I was like, well, when we have arguments, I guess, at the home group, we talk about it and we get everybody's input. And I know other businesses may have already done this, but it was like a novel idea to me. And I had this idea, well, why don't I just talk to everybody and see what's best for everybody? And basically what happened was I talked to them about the schedule and I said, why don't you guys make the schedule? You figure it out. You work, here's the hours. I mean, I was a hero. They thought I was like the best thing in the world. But what I learned from that was that I'm trying to do it all by myself. I got great people here that are willing to help me. I should let them. And that I should get consensus from people. And we never had a problem with schedule after that, never. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that through the first tradition. I learned through the second tradition of how to listen to people. And the second tradition talks about a group conscience. Right? It talks about how we get our answers in AA through a loving God that's expressed through a group conscience. So a group conscience is something that develops through lots of talking, you know, lots of input, lots of information. And for me, if I'm going to actually, now I'm a guy who thinks I know a lot and I think I'm smarter than everybody else. So I don't listen to a whole lot of people, right? Because I already know the answers. The second tradition, I've learned through my group how to actually listen. If I'm going to listen for God in people, or I'm going to listen for God in a group, I got to shut the noise down in my mind about what I think I know is best and actually listen to people. And there's a prayer in the 12 and 12, that prayer of St. Francis, where he talks about seek first to understand and to be understood. That's the second tradition. And so I started trying to apply that at home. I remember I hadn't been sober all that long, and I went to the grocery store, and don't know why this popped in my head, but it kind of ties in with the tradition. I bought some potato chips. I bought a bunch of stuff, but my wife opened up the bag of potato chips that I bought, and evidently they were like stale or soggy, and she bit into the potato chips, and she says, these potato chips are stale. What I heard was, you dumb SOB, how dare you buy stale potato chips? Now, that is not what she said. Not even close. That's, my mind is just screwed up. I hear things that aren't there. And I immediately got, all she said was, these potato chips are stale. I got defensive. I'm like, well, how in the heck was I supposed to know that? I mean, what are you talking about? Why don't you go buy your own potato chips? And she like backed up and she's like, all I said was the potato chips were stale. So I kind of learned through that. That was one of my first experiences of knowing that my filter in my mind is, in my ears, is a little different, that I don't hear things quite right. And I should really start slowing down and listening to people when they talk, instead of, you know, automatically thinking what I know. If I don't know, I should ask some clarifying questions before I damn start shooting off at people. But this is that's what the second tradition has kind of taught me, to listen to people. And I'm a guy that when you start talking to me and you share something with me, I'm immediately trying to think it through my experience. And I'm immediately, while you're talking, I'm working on my response to you. Even though you've not asked me for a response, I'm working on my response to you, because I'm so great, and I'm going to save you from things because of my experience. I've learned to not do that through the second tradition. I've learned to just listen and try to understand before I respond. And also, the other question that happens to me with the second tradition is that it talks about a loving God. And so I try to listen for God in people when they're talking to me. I also ask myself the question, do I let a loving God direct my words? Do I let a loving God direct my actions? And if you don't like that word, you can just think about the term love. So are my words, you know, spoken with love? Are my actions spoken with love? It's what the tradition says. And I'll consciously try to think about that second tradition when I'm interacting with people, especially if it's a situation that could have some conflict or resistance with people. I try to think about those first two traditions, about what's best for this person or what's best for the whole, instead of just thinking what's best for me. I love the third tradition. Alcoholics Anonymous will take anybody, right? If you got a problem with drinking, you got a problem with alcohol, we don't care what any other problem you got. So Alcoholics Anonymous is extremely non-prejudiced. Right. And I learned that in AA to help anybody that needs help, regardless of where they came from or who they are, or lifestyle or color or language or any of that, I'll help you. And I can assure you, before I got here, I grew up in a prejudiced home. I grew up where you, certain types of people, we didn't help them, and they, AA has freed me from that for the most part. Even in my life and my family, I've got, and this is an example, I've got nieces and nephews that have, and some cousins that have made different life choices than I would say my parents or grandparents made. They've been in interracial marriages or lifestyle, living a lifestyle that wouldn't be approved of by my parents or grandparents. My grandparents are dead now, but even some of my aunts and uncles. And they'll sit around and talk about that. And they'll exclude people from certain events because of this. And me and my wife both made the decision a long time ago, we weren't going to participate in that. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't participate in those discussions. I don't use those terms. If we participate and we ask people, those folks, we love them. I I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, to not judge people and to welcome people and my family regardless of the decision that they made. I personally wouldn't do some of the things that they do, but I'm not going to exclude them from my life because I disagree with the decision that they made. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that business that I worked at, I don't know why this popped in my mind, but years ago, it was kind of mostly men and brouhaha. I hate all that brouhaha that men do. I was hiring for this position. It was for an installer that installed telephones. And I was taught interview people and hire the best person. Well, the best person for this job at the time was a female. And there was no, in the whole company, there were no female installers. And I remember when I went to my boss and I told him who I was going to hire, and they're like, whoa, wait a minute now. You sure you want to do that? They're worried about perception and all this. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure I want to do it. It's the best person. There were a lot of folks that were hesitant to let me do that, but I did it. Worked out perfect. I mean, it was, matter of fact, I think the girl still works for that company. I don't, but I think she does. Point being, I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have known that on my own. I learned how to overcome those prejudices and those fixed ideas and that judgment through my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly from the third step, right? People, third tradition. People don't have to conform to anything to be a member of AA. You ain't got to take out your earrings and get rid of your tattoos. Now, you might in some groups. Alcoholics Anonymous don't. That's just an example. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't demand that at all. We'll take it just as you are. Number four talks about that groups basically are, there's no authority over a group except its group conscience, unless they're going to make a decision that impacts another group. And so what I think about on number four is there's a lot of freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous for groups to do what they want to do. A group can have an hour and a half long meeting, and they can have an ask it basket. There's nobody from New York or D.C. or Richmond or wherever. There ain't nobody going to say anything to you. They're not going to come down and shut you down. There's nobody that's going to tell you what you got to read or what you got to pray. We don't do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we give groups a lot of freedom to make their own decisions. We also give groups a lot of freedom to make mistakes. But we're not scared that you're going to hurt anybody. And with that freedom, though, comes a lot of responsibility. Right? We are responsible to help other alcoholics. And we're also responsible to not do anything that's going to greatly affect Alcoholics Anonymous or the name of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we're going to do that, we should talk to somebody first. So personally, this tradition fits great in my life because it tells me to start really thinking about my decisions, thinking long-term about decisions, and talking to people before I make those decisions. Now, I'm a guy, before I got sober, I lived on feelings and emotions. Man, I thought about it, I just kind of went and did it. And if I felt bad, I did something bad. If I felt good, I did something good. And nothing was based in fact or reality. Right, I lived on feelings and emotions, and I didn't care what other people thought about things that I did. I mean, I did, but I didn't think about you before I made a decision. If I wanted to do something, I just did it. If it impacted you, you just had to deal with that. Fourth tradition tells me to not do that, and I've learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, to really try to make good decisions and to get wise counsel and to I wanted to buy a BMW one time. And he would, my whole way of doing it, I just go buy it. Fourth tradition tells me I probably should talk to my wife about it before I go do that. Right? And I did. We bought it. But I talked to her first. Right, so when I worked for that company, I at one point I was one of three kind of directors over the country. And we all had kind of autonomy to do what we wanted to do, but But if we made a decision, like on a sales promotion or something like that, it could affect the other region where the borders and stores and stuff were. And I learned through the fourth tradition that I probably should get along with my neighbors. And that if I was going to do something crazy, like I did a crazy promotion one time for some cell phones, I talked to the neighboring region first, got their buy-in. That's an example of the tradition. If I'm going to make some kind of decision that's going to impact other people, I should talk to them first, get their buy-in. And, you know, that's the fourth tradition. I for me, it's one of my favorite ones because it also tells me that I shouldn't try to have authority over people. That in my family, I'm again back to that first tradition, I'm just one among many, that I shouldn't try to have authority or be the governor. And the other thing it tells me to do is that A lets groups make their own mistakes. I should let other people make their own mistakes. But I'm a guy that I like to help people and I like to save people. And I'll jump in and say, hey, well, let me share my experience with you to save you from this. And the fourth tradition teaches me to let people have their own experience, right? Unless they're at somebody that's actually asking you something, maybe keep your opinion to yourself or keep your experience to yourself. Let people have their own, make their own mistakes and give people that freedom. Number five talks about primary purpose. And now you don't hang in with me. Now I know that this stuff is deep, but, and again, this is a, you know, nobody speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous. These are just my experiences. And I hope that by talking about some of the stuff, it just gets you thinking about what they mean to you. You don't necessarily have to believe exactly what I believe. The fifth tradition talks about primary purpose. And I mean, before I got here, my main purpose was to drink and shut down the noise in the head. And AA does one thing supremely well. We help alcoholics. And I've learned that in AA, that if you stick to one thing and be the best at it, that you can go far. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most successful thing that happened to an alcoholic that's ever happened. That same principle applies to other stuff. So when I'm at work, my primary purpose should be to do the job they pay me to do. That would exclude sitting in the break room gossiping about what other people are doing. That would exclude surfing Facebook and Instagram and Snapchatter while I'm at work. That would exclude making personal phone calls, things like that. So I'm jumping all over the place. The fifth tradition's taught me to stick to a purpose. When I'm at home, I should probably try to have some quiet time with my family and not be on that phone all the time. What happens is if I'm trying to have some quality time with a family member or a friend and I look at that phone, what I just said was the phone's more important than you. And I've hurt my purpose of why I'm there. I've hurt that relationship. I devalued it. And so I try to do that. I try to have some uninterrupted time with family. I try to have uninterrupted time with sponsees. I try to have, when I'm working, I try to be focused on what I'm doing. So I've learned that in the fifth tradition, that's what it is. And the AA has given me a purpose, right? I've got a lot of obviously purpose is to help alcoholics, but it's helped me have a purpose at life. It's helped me have a purpose at work. And it's helped me to kind of stay focused on those things instead of, I mean, before everything was up for grabs and everything was an option and I would change with the wind depending on what was going on. And that doesn't work good for life. And the fifth tradition has taught me to just stick to a few things and do those as best as I can. To stop jumping and wavering. And a lot of times that takes a lot of patience, that takes a lot of pain. stick with something long term. Six is my favorite tradition because to me it tells me why people relapse. And it's very instructive to me on how I should live. And the very first sentence in a long form, I'll read it, says problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. So what that tells me is that, and what it tells Alcoholics Anonymous is don't let property, money, authority, and prestige get in the way of helping an alcoholic. Don't let those things get in the way of the primary spiritual aim of carrying the message. What it tells me is that great job that I've gotten because I'm sober, that great relationship I'm in because I'm sober, all that great material stuff that I've been given because I'm sober, don't let that become more important than living a spiritual life. And if I let the job become more important than going to my home group, if I let the job become more important than going to the detox on Friday night, if I let the relationship become more important than meeting with a guy that I sponsor, if I let the relationship become more important than calling my sponsor, if I let all that material stuff become more important than making it to my home group, or if I let all that material stuff become more important than praying in the morning and connecting with God and reading AA literature, I'm in trouble. And I've seen it happen. I think I said that at the beginning of the meeting. I've seen this happen to so many people that the life that we've been given because we're sober becomes more important. And I've been taught by men in AA that the more stuff I get, or the better my life gets, the more active I need to be. The busier I become with regular life, the busier I need to be with spiritual activities. It doesn't work the other way around. When I got into a great relationship, this was my second wife. Me and the first wife didn't make it, but when I got into that relationship, I was told, whatever you were doing when you got into the relationship, you need to keep doing. Right? But many times we stop doing those things because Valentine's night at dinner is more important than going to the home group. Working late to make another $8 is more important than going to the prison. Sleeping in a little late because I'm tired is more important than praying. I'm saying all these things because I've done them years ago. And then what happens is that crazy thinking in my mind starts coming back. And the further I get away from the spiritual activities, and I'm not just talking about going to meetings. Meetings is just a small part of what we do. But the further I get away, the closer I get to drinking. Or the closer I get to committing suicide again. And so what the sixth tradition has just taught me that is to not let all that stuff become more important than growing spiritually. And that there's time for everything. I don't care how busy my life has gotten. There's always been time to pray. There's always been time to go to my own group. There's always been time to sponsor people. It's never gotten in the way. Seven tells me that I should stop being lazy and go to work. it talks about being self-supporting. And now I'm like a lot of people. I wasn't self-supporting before I got here. I mooched off of people and I expected others to do stuff for me. I expected my family to take care of me. Seven traditions taught me to pay my own way. It's taught me to be responsible with money. It's taught me to be charitable to others, if I can. And I learned that in the seventh tradition. I learned how to live within my means. I haven't always done that. After I got divorced the first time, and me and Sarah got married. We've been married now for, I don't know, about 25 years. I was in debt, bad, and ran up more debt. And this was after making a lot of financial amends. And we prayed about it one day. We wrote down what we were going to do, and we prayed about what we were going to do. And it wasn't, you know, we never thought we'd be out of debt. Few years we were, because of the seventh tradition and bringing God into it and trying to be self-supporting and trying to not do things that we couldn't afford. And that's what the seventh tradition has taught me. It's also taught me to be charitable and to give back if I can. And I'm a guy that loves to mooch off of people. I love other people doing stuff for me. And I love, you know, making people feel sorry for me, mostly my family. So they'll do stuff for me. And I haven't borrowed any money from my family in over 28 years because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the seventh tradition. And number 8 talks about that AA is not professional. We should be non-professional. And that we should do what we do for free and for fun in AA. Now, personally, it's kind of hard to tie that, but one thing I look at on that is that if I need a job done, I probably should hire a professional. I'm going to do it myself. I had a hot tub that broke down one time, and I thought I was a hot tub technician, and I started messing with that thing. I wasn't going to call anybody because I didn't want anybody to think I could fix something. Yeah, I was messing with that thing, and it started smoking and sparking. And about $500 later, I wish I'd have called the guy to start with. So I should call an actual professional to do certain things. But it also, for me, I've been, you know, AA is full of a lot of talented people. We've got people that can do anything. And I've been given certain, you know, gifts with certain things. And I should, in AA, we give freely of our time. AA has also taught me to give freely of my time in the community. And that, you know, I've been able to teach kids through a program called Junior Achievement, you know, the importance of capitalism and kind of how things work and how the financial system works. I did that for free. Been able to give back to the homeless community and do things in the homeless community because of my background. And so the eighth tradition to me is kind of, it's taught me to kind of give back to the community without any real kind of thought of having any kind of return or profit motive. And I just do that because it's the right thing to do. And I'm coming up on my time here. Don't worry. I'm going to get through this, David. Don't give up on me, brother. I only got about 3 more left, and I'm going to scorch through these pretty quick. Just a couple things on 9 and 10. You know, the long form of 9 talks about trusted servants and leaders. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the world is in desperate need of good leaders, just desperate need of people that are willing to help out and to be of service and that aren't afraid, that have confidence and strength and want to support others. But 9 has taught me, if you read that long form, it talks about if somebody asks me to do something, I should do it. If I agree to do something, I should do it. I should honor that commitment. And man, I was a commitment breaker before I got sober. You couldn't trust me. You couldn't rely on me for anything. And AA in the ninth tradition has taught me to honor commitments. It's taught me to not agree to anything that I can't do. And I'll do that. I'll say yes to everything. Knowing daggone well, I can't do it or I'm not going to be able to be there. I don't do that anymore. I stop and think through before I answer the question. And a perfect example is my family. I mean, I was so unreliable, especially with my parents. And I guarantee you right now, if you call them and talk to them, they would tell you that Jerry's very reliable. If I say I'm going to be there tomorrow at 10 o'clock to cut my dad's grass, There's no 54 phone calls anymore like there used to be. Hey, are you coming? Are you coming? One call, he knows I'm going to be there. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also learned how to not oppose people that I don't agree with through the 10th tradition. And controversial tradition nowadays. But what it's taught me is to not be antagonistic for the sake of being antagonistic. Don't pick fights with people just for the sake of picking fights with people. It's taught me that the truth doesn't need to be defended. That I don't need to argue about something that, you know, the truth is the truth. And it's taught me to just be neutral, and that getting along with people and trying to be helpful to somebody is way more important than debating and arguing values and issues. And that I want to be a peacemaker, and I want to try to help anybody that I can help. And if we're arguing about what the tradition calls outside issues, which are mostly politics, religion, and alcohol reform, it's hard to help somebody. Very, very hard to help somebody. I don't care what your views are on things. If you're an alcoholic and you want help, I'm going to help you. I hope you'll let me help you. And I've also learned in 10 is we all got views and opinions on stuff. So out and with my family or out in the community or at work, if there's something that we are talking about, I've learned just to state my case or to state my experience or to state my opinion and just leave it there and be done with it. I'm not going to keep arguing with somebody about stuff like about that stuff. And I've learned through AA that it's okay to disagree with people and to have different views and still be their friend. Seems like that's fading a little bit, but anonymity. Oh man, another one. We could have a whole half day conference on anonymity and the bad information that's out there about anonymity and just the kind of all the different misconceptions about it. What I'd say about it in just a couple of minutes personally is that it's taught me to not have to praise myself. It's taught me to be humble for the most part. Again, these are just perfect principles. I don't do them perfectly. But I worked for a company for 24 years. Went from sweeping the floors to being a president of one of their businesses. It was way in over my head. And I never asked for a raise. I never asked for a promotion. Those things were given to me by the example of working. Those things came when they were supposed to by me working hard and setting a good example. I didn't have to go promote myself. Now there's a whole new way that people do things nowadays, and there's these HR gurus that are telling people you got to self-promote. You don't have to do that. As a matter of fact, in most cases, it hurts you. What I did was I just worked hard, and I was grateful that they let me work there. I never felt entitled or demanded anything. I just did my job. I did the best I could. And slowly over time, I got some incredible benefits out of it. I learned through 11 and 12 that I didn't have to praise myself. I didn't have to self-promote. That I let my example, the example, speak for me. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. We let the living example of our recovered members show other people how good we are. How good the program works. It works in everywhere, in my family and at home and at work, that I don't have to do that. That I can live an attitude of gratitude. I can live a life of gratitude that's expressed to people, that's transmitted to people by living that way. I'll share one quick story with you, and I'm going to shut it down. This gets at steps 10, at tradition 10 or 11 and 12. We used to have this, go to my brother's in Atlanta for Thanksgiving. All the family would come, and we'd hang out there for about a week. It was a good time. My younger brother wasn't there this particular time because he's he's somewhat of a celebrity in the field he's in. And at that time, he had just written a book. And he was on Good Morning America and 2020 and other stuff. And I won't bore you with the details and all that. But we're at my older brother's house, and my mom starts spouting out about how great my younger brother is. And I've always had a complex. I know she likes him better than me anyway. But she was telling me how great he was and all these things he's done. And I'm sitting there just stewing, and all this old crap's come back in my mind. And she wanting to watch the video again of him on Good Morning America and all this nonsense. And now in my mind, I'm thinking, again, I'm hearing stuff different. All she's doing is talking about how great one of her sons is, right? It was all actual factual information. What I hear is Jerry's a piece of trash. John's better than Jerry. Just womp, womp, womp. No, I mean, it ain't what she was saying. And I'm thinking, my mom, well, come on, Mom, don't you know how great I am? I mean, I'm working at a company now, and I'm the youngest executive there, and they wrote an article about me in a business journal one time. And I'm not saying any of this, but that's what I'm thinking. Mom. I got resentful. I'm not going to lie about it. I got resentful and kind of shut down and wasn't hardly talking to anybody for the next 2 days. And I got home. I guess it was Sunday. It was that Sunday night after Thanksgiving. Still mad as fire. Went to my home group, and it was tradition night. And this guy read the 11th tradition. And he came right out with, hey, look, the tradition tells us there's no reason to praise ourselves. And that you know, that he told this story about how, you know, he didn't self-promote or do any of that. And it just hit me right between the eyes. And I heard the truth that my mom didn't say any of that stuff. I thought she said she was just talking about how great one of her sons was. Didn't mean that she didn't care about me. And basically what happened, I say that to say this, is that when he read that, the 11th tradition to the group that night, I realized that, man, I've been given an awesome life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, I hope that shows through, you know, an example and through life and the way that I live. And you don't have to, you know, be a showboat or be an AA celebrity. And you don't have to, you know, that we're taught here to be humble. And we're taught here to give all the thanks and to the program and to the God and the people, not to me. That anything I've been given since I've gotten sober, it's a gift from God, and it's a direct result of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I appreciate y'all listening to me. Thanks. Sorry for going long, Dave.
Oh, that was wonderful, Jerry. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute at will if you want to say thank you to Jerry.
Good job, Jerry.
Thank you, 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 Jerry.
Jerry Weaver.
Yes.
That was amazing, Jerry. We're going to we'll give you a break. I'll do some the seven tradition stuff. I'll take the meeting back for a moment. Mute everybody. And so I'm going to paste this link in here again to the Simple Actions PayPal. The Seven Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. So please, we're just by way of reminder, please send your questions for Jerry to the user questions. We've got several in the queue. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'll take a couple of announcements for the good of AA. Anybody want to raise their virtual blue hand and I'll unmute you? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or are in need of a sponsor, please hang out at the after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship, I'll do last call on announcements. I see none. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we'll be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So that's that. And we're going to reconvene for questions here. We got quite a few. Jerry, how quickly do you take someone through the steps?
As quickly as they'll let me. So, it can vary, but typically if somebody asks me to sponsor them, we'll meet immediately. And we'll kind of go through what the process is, and I'll immediately get them started on the steps. So that might look like reading the book to them directly right then, or for some folks, for many folks I have, if they're ready, I've taken them first through the first three steps in one sitting and get them right in the inventory. So it really depends on the person, but there's some level of step work immediately.
All right. Let's see. A member asks, do you think that there is an amount of time that someone should be sober before they start sponsoring others? Should someone be done with the steps before they sponsor?
Well, in general, I would advise somebody to have gotten to step 9 before they start sponsoring. It's different for each person. I mean, some people are a little more advanced, ain't the right word, but. To actually officially sponsor somebody, I think you would have had to have taken the steps. Yeah. I mean, I think you can help anybody different ways, but you would have had to have had the experience of the steps to transmit that to somebody else.
So for clarity, I'm hearing you tie it to an experience with the steps rather than time.
Correct. Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I mean, if you've taken those steps and have had an experience and you're sober 2 months, sponsor somebody.
All right. That's it. All right. How can I learn to be more tolerant of people and situations, accepting people where they are?
A few things that have helped me with that are prayer. So if I'm with somebody or talking to somebody and I start the judgment or thinking I know better or whatever, I'll try to immediately pray and ask for it. It could be a simple prayer. God, please help me. God, please help me. I'm a guy that still uses the serenity prayer. I was taught to say that prayer over and over and over and over again, and it tells me to accept the things I cannot change and So when I can remember to do that, I tend to do pretty well. I like the word pause that's in the 11th step. It took me years to kind of really get good at using it, but it tells us when we get doubtful or agitated. Agitated is just another word for judging. That I should pause and pray and ask for help. And then there's other things. I know that, everybody's struggling, right? No matter who you are, we're all struggling in our own way. And if you could really look down in anybody's heart and see what's really going on with them, we probably all would have more compassion for each other. And so that second tradition of trying to see God and see the good in people, just trying to practice that has helped me. I don't know about anybody else, but if I get honest about it, I ain't got no right to look down my nose at anybody for things I've done. And if I look at what I've done. Yeah, so.
All right. This is kind of a related question, but a member asks, what do love and tolerance mean to you?
Well, interesting thing about tolerance, I was just talking to somebody about this. The word tolerance, even in the word patience, that's not what you asked. So tolerance is one of those words that's changed meaning over time. If you actually look the word up, it talks about kind of, we think of tolerance as, I'm going to tolerate that. It really means willingly accepting somebody for who they are, willingly accepting somebody's differences. It's something that you just got to practice at. It's just letting people be who they are and really kind of thinking about that third step decision that I made years ago, where I gave up the management of my life and I gave up the management of other people's lives. And I can still, we don't think about it like this, but I can still run the show or try to play God in my mind. So I might not be outwardly doing it to people, but in my mind, I'm thinking, why can't she see this? Why can't he understand this? And all that is running the show in my mind. I'm still trying to be the director. And all that does is drive me crazy. And it hurts me. So I try to remind myself that I've given up managing other people's lives. That means I'm going to try to give it up in my thinking as well. And I'm going to try to truly practice love and tolerance. And love is just, it's really just trying to help people and to be a good guy and to accept folks for who they are and to try not to change people. And, yeah.
All right. Thank you. Can you talk about what being a home group member means to you or some of your experience being a home group member?
I can. I have a lot of experience at this. So what that means to me is it means getting there early and helping us set up. It means getting there early and showing newer people how to set up, how to make coffee, sharing those responsibilities with folks. This is just me. I try to personally talk to everybody that comes to my group. So I personally try to go up and obviously prior to Zoom, shake people's hands and introduce myself if I don't know them and make personal contact with everybody. I was taught to do that as a newcomer. It gets me out of myself and makes people feel welcome. I try to participate by just sharing my experience. try to get other people to participate. And I'm there, unless I'm, you know, dead or out of town, I'm at my home group. I don't miss that commitment. It's one of the most important things that I do. And I just try to participate. I also try, I mean, the group I'm in now, we're 10 years old. Me and a few other folks started the group. And, you know, I'm unfortunately a leader in the group, and kind of they look at me for all kinds of answers and stuff. And I try to get away from that and take a more low profile and let the group make decisions and not try to be a governor and to dominate. And that's tough because, you know, I've got ideas on how the group should be, and the group has grown a lot over the last few years, and it's made some decisions and done some things that I personally wouldn't have done. But part of being in the group is trusting the group conscience and listening to the group conscience and kind of paying a back seat and not trying to influence stuff. But, you know, I love my home group. I've always been a home group member. It's where I've learned to practice love and tolerance. It's where I've learned to let people be who they are, and that it's okay. And that, so I don't know if it answered the question or not.
But. No, beautiful. Thank you. Would you care to elaborate on your 11th step practices?
Sure. I think the 11th step is very personal. And I don't think there's a right or a wrong way to do it. It's changed many, many, many times throughout the years. I've tried and have experimented with all kinds of stuff. And I would encourage other people to experiment. And instead of focusing on what doesn't work or what you're not willing to do, focus on what you are willing to do and try to find something that'll work. But I tell you an example today. I mean, when I woke up this morning, I've been experimenting with this for a while now. When I wake up, right when I open my eyes, I immediately pray. And I'll immediately ask God to help me before I even get out of the bed now. I didn't used to do that. And then I'll try to think about other people that I know that need help. And because normally right when I... For years, I'd wake up and I'd just be obsessed with myself and obsessed about the day and obsessed about, I'm going to do this. And so I've tried to break that kind of cycle by right when I wake up, I'm still laying in bed. I ask God for help. Please help me, guide me, and direct me. And I'll start praying for a few people that I know need help. And then I got up and I read, I have a book that's called The Daily Word that I read. And I'll fluctuate between different books. I've read all of them, and I'll filter through. But I read what that said, and then I sat there for a few minutes and visualized my day and kind of like the big book talks about it. I asked God to direct my thinking, and I thought about meetings that I had today and a couple of things I had to go to and a few phone calls, and I just kind of visualized myself doing that with love and with tolerance and with willingness and enthusiasm and some laughter. And then finished that off for prayer and asked God to help me. All of that was about 30 minutes. And then I went about my day. So I think it's, you know, technique's not important. It's people need to do something that'll work for them, and they need to find something, they need to have fun with it.
All right. All right. We knew this question was coming. Is your significant other in the program? And what would you advise a sponsee on seeking a relationship in the program?
Whoa.
I'm going to go out and come in again.
Run. It's all right to laugh, folks. Come on. Have a little time. My wife is not in the program. We met at work, and she doesn't drink. Well, I've tried to get her really drunk a few times at like Christmas parties and stuff, but she's a strange lady. She's normal as best as I can tell, has healthy relationships with her family, talks to her family all the time. Doesn't get riled up about much. She gets mad, she'll tell you about it, and then she gets over it. I've never quite understood all these things, but she's not in the program. When we first started dating and got engaged, and for a number of years after we got married, she participated in open AA meetings. She would come to a lot of speaker meetings with me and conferences and stuff like that. She did go to Al-Anon a few times when we first started dating, just to kind of see what it was about. She didn't quite understand why people were going to complain about other people. But she's probably not the best Al-Anon meeting to, but so no, she's not. She's always been supportive of my membership and my involvement. And it's never been I'm busy. I'm busy with Alcoholics Anonymous activities, and I'm busy with work stuff and life. And it's never been a problem for us. As far as, I don't know what the question was, if you're asking if you should have a relationship with somebody in the program, I would advise to call your sponsor. But I know that I've seen it work and I've seen it not work. So
All right. I
avoided that question.
Okay, I'll let you. Here's a tasty one. What's one of the biggest mistakes you've made in sobriety that you now use often as a tool to help others?
There's a lot. Two things that come to mind is that first marriage. I stayed in it for a number of years sober, knowing that it wasn't the right thing for either one of us. Not live in the most principled way, mostly all because of fear. I was afraid that there wasn't something better for me. I was afraid of losing what I thought I had, not being able to find something else. So I stayed in that relationship way longer than I should have, mostly just because of fear and being a little bit in delusion. And it took people in AA to get both of us see the truth about the relationship. We were, both of us were way better off away from each other. I also, first 3-4 years I was sober, I stole money from work. Off and on through those years of doing work and not writing up invoices for it and pocketing money. So I don't recommend that. And all that was out of fear and entitlement. You know, that I work hard and you don't pay me enough. I'm entitled to this. I'm afraid that you know, if I'm actually principled about money, I'm not going to be taken care of. And I can tell you the good thing about all that is I got through both of those because of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. I was able to turn myself in for stealing money, and I paid the money back and some other things. But I got through both of those. I've hadn't stolen anything since. I made the amends for that. It was a lot of money. And I've not been in an unhealthy relationship or treated a woman the way that I treated my first wife since getting through that experience. So I don't know if that answers the question, but life will visit. I mean, none of us are exempt from anything in life. And when I first got sober, I kind of had this in my mind that life's just going to automatically be great. And it's not.
All right. We're short on time. You've been very generous with yours, but I got to ask this. How has the program or your application of the program changed during the pandemic?
That's not completely true. So let me say this, that And it's some of this stuff has not been popular. This is not the first time it's come up. And my sponsor and there's a group of us who made a decision that we were going to try to keep life as normal as possible through this. And that we were going to try not, as best as we could, within the confines of what we've been given to work with, we were going to try not to deviate from our schedules and our commitments. And hence why I'm still wearing a tie and a, this was a commitment we made to each other. It's why I'm still wearing a tie and a suit. I want this meeting to feel just like I was actually at your church. Now I know that sounds a little goofy, but it's just kind of what we decided to do. So, my home group is still met face to face. We've not missed a meeting. We do Zoom, and we Zoom in and do the meeting in the room at the same time. And now we recommend that most people do Zoom, but not everybody was willing to do Zoom. And so the group made a decision that we were going to do both. And we believed that I'm just sharing what our group is. I'm not saying you kind of buy into this, but we made a decision that if we went exclusively Zoom, that we were doing a few things. We were creating an accessibility issue for some people that couldn't access Zoom because either they don't have Wi-Fi or a computer or a smartphone, and that we didn't want to do that to everybody. And it was almost like an added membership requirement that we were going to tell our members that, hey, you got to have Wi-Fi or a smartphone in order to get onto our meeting. And we decided we didn't want to do that. And we've got older members that can't do it. So hence, that's why we had some people that don't connect spiritually and mentally and emotionally on electronic ways. So our group has continued to meet face to face and on Zoom. Now the participation face to face has been minimal. It's been about 10 people and then 30 or 40 on Zoom. But we've continued to do that. And we've had some people that have basically said, save their life. We've been extremely criticized in the AA community for that. We've had, people called the police on us. We've had the health department called. We've continued to meet, and we've not been shut down, and the church supports what we're doing. As far as meeting with like sponsees, now that's changed. A lot of sponsees that are afraid to meet face to face. So I've done Zoom with people. I've done phone calls. All the restaurants and coffee shops have been shut down for a couple months now. So they'll do takeout. So I still meet with a lot of people face to face. We'll go to the drive through at the coffee shop, and then we'll meet in separate cars, kind of pull up to each other, roll the windows down, and we'll meet that way. But some of us are still show up at the home group at 5:30 to sit up, and then we walk across to a restaurant and get takeout, and we eat out in the parking lot on some benches, and then we participate in the group. So we've not done anything irresponsible. We're not asking babies, we're not killing babies and old people like I keep getting told. We believe that most people should stay home. We're not asking everybody to come, but there's a few people that need it face to face. So that's not changed. And so we've tried to keep things as normal as possible and keep people safe. So I don't know if that answered the question or not, but it's been helpful to me. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from people that have tried to keep their schedule normal as best as you can. We're looking at what we can do instead of what we can't do. And I think it's helped people's mental health. So thanks.
Right. Thank you so much. All right, do you guys have the ability to unmute if you'd like to say thank you or applaud? Thank you, Jerry.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry. Good job.
Thanks, Jerry. You did a great job.
Yep.
You carried the message wonderful tonight. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, Lucy.
All right. For those who care to, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.